ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, host of All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, and I have a question for you. Have you ever wondered what is going on inside someone else's head? I think about this a lot because on All in the Mind, we cover psychology and mental health and why people behave the way they do.
How do other people make this decision?
Maybe it's sending a signal to someone about the reliability of someone.
How can this possibly be?
So if you like the sound of that, check out All in the Mind on the ABC Listen app.
Kylie, it's been 4 years next week since Russian tanks rolled over the border into Ukraine.
That's right, Latika. Peace talks are underway, organised by the Americans, but progress is pitifully slow.
And at the summit in Munich over the weekend, Ukraine's name was barely spoken, even though the drone strikes have never stopped.
Many Ukrainians are enduring the icy cold without power or heating, so how has Ukraine slipped off the security agenda? I'm Kylie Morris.
And I'm Latika Burke. This is Global Roaming.
So, Latika, let's talk about, firstly, the inspiration for this episode. It was something that came up in your conversation with Geraldine about what you saw at the Munich conference. Explain that for us.
Well, there was this startling and I think very arresting divergence between what is facing Europe as its greatest security threat, and this is an imperialistic Russia on the eastern border invading Ukraine, killing Ukrainians, bombing their energy sources, trying to freeze them to death quite literally. And yet in Munich, there was almost no discussion from the people that could bring about an end to this horrific situation. Chief amongst them was Marco Rubio, US Secretary of State, who is considered by the Europeans to be the good guy, the grown-up, the one they all like in the Trump administration, the one they all wish was handling negotiations. It's been said that if it was Rubio in charge, things would be a lot better and we could possibly get an outcome. You know, Rubio is widely perceived in Europe to not have diverged on Russia. He understands the threat they pose. You wouldn't necessarily have known that from the way he approached the Munich Security Conference. It was very much a second helping of what J.D. Vance delivered up last year. And that was to completely almost ignore the situation in Ukraine and focus on domestic politics in Europe as being the biggest threat and certainly the focus of the Trump administration when it comes to Europe. So I think we both felt, let's delve into that dynamic a little more.
I mean, one of the things that I'm really curious about, and just to pick up on what you're saying there, is I understand why the Americans don't want to talk about Ukraine, but why aren't the Europeans making more of it? It seems to me, I suppose my fear is that they're so anxious about the state of the transatlantic relationship and trying to somehow find a way to stay at least in a conversation with President Trump, that as soon as they mention Ukraine, it puts them on a collision course with Washington. And I wonder whether they are in some way, I don't know, cowed in the conversation about Ukraine or persuaded from not being too vocal about it at these international forums because they don't want to cause more problems than they already have with President Trump.
I think there's two things going on. One, the obvious threat to the transatlantic alliance has seized them. You know, suddenly security is existential for them. It's just not how they were previously metastasizing this or calculating or factoring this in. It's not that the Ukraine war might spill over that will threaten them. That's not the threat they're thinking about anymore. It's, oh my goodness, the Trump administration might invade Greenland. Oh my goodness, doing that would collapse NATO. Oh my goodness, then we might not have an Article 5 backup. Where would that leave us? Now, by extension, that conversation doesn't preclude Ukrainian security long term. In fact, if anything, it could lead to a better and more stable situation for Ukraine. If you have a Europe that's in some point in time ready and able to look after itself and incorporates Ukraine into that fold, it's not a terrible outcome, Kylie, but right now we're so far from that that it's very hard for a lot of people to peer over the edge of the precipice that's put in right in front of them. And there's absolutely no doubt about it that the start of this year were two things: Venezuela, the obvious demonstrated ability of Donald Trump to use American power for his own interests economically, and then turn that around to Europe and say, hey, we're eyeing off Greenland as well. It is just so difficult for them to comprehend and register that shock. And I think they're the tremors that we're seeing play through in the conversation.
I know you're preparing for a trip to Ukraine very soon. So I think it's really important that we meet our next guest, because he is someone who has written extensively about that place, about the conflict, and really stays across the very latest developments in terms of how the international community is responding. His name is Yaroslav Trofimov. He is really a leading voice on reporting the war. He's currently the chief foreign affairs correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. He was born in Soviet Ukraine, but is now based in Dubai. So let's hear from him now.
Yaroslav Trofimov, great to have you on Global Roaming. What was your impression of how much a priority Ukraine was at this year's Munich Security Conference compared to previous years?
Well, you know, the focus in Munich this year, actually the last year as well, was on the broader rift in the transatlantic relationship between the United States and its European partners. And the root cause of this rift actually has a lot to do with Ukraine. Because even if you're not talking about Ukraine as such, you are having a very different approach to what to Europeans are the existential security challenge of Europe. Because if you look at it from Europe, your biggest threat, the threat to not just in Ukraine, but the threat to the sovereignty and independence of some of the members of the European Union and NATO is Russia. And European countries are rearming very fast, and European governments are talking very seriously about the need to defend against a potential Russian invasion of the European Union in a not so distant future. Now, if you look at it from Washington, President Trump is talking about Russia not as as a potential rival, not as a threat to be contained, but as a source of investment deals, business opportunities, as a potential partner against China, and is viewing it in a completely different logic. And so that's where Ukraine fits in, because you know the whole premise of Trump's pressure on the Europeans and the Ukrainians to settle the war on Russian terms is so that he could open up these business opportunities with Russia. And so in Munich this year, you know, Secretary of State's Rubio's speech didn't even mention the word Russia. And obviously it shows you how different are the priorities on the two sides.
Yaroslav, Volodymyr Zelensky did appear in Munich. He talked about the fact that he is not getting the kind of security guarantees that he wants from the United States. He talked about the situation facing the fighters in his country. He mentioned that Russia had launched about 1,300 attack drones, 1,200 guided aerial bombs, and dozens of ballistic missiles at Ukraine over the past week alone. So it's one thing in terms of politics for Marco Rubio not to mention the name Ukraine, but how is this not a major focus for everyone at that conference for strategic reasons alone? I mean, you don't need to talk about the Russian threat in the abstract. It's happening before their very eyes in Ukraine.
Well, you know, I would not say it's not a strategic focus for the Europeans. The Europeans are investing very heavily. You know, Germany, the host of this conference, since the last one, changed its constitution to dramatically expand its ability to borrow money to fund the defense. And, you know, it's a revolution in terms of military spending in Germany and also in other countries in Europe, like Poland, Scandinavian nations. Just on the sidelines of this conference, President Zelensky and the German defense minister opened the first of what's going to be a series of joint factories making weapons using Ukrainian technologies on German soil. The problem with the Russian ballistic and cruise missile attacks and drone attacks is that Ukraine is very, very short on interceptors for its air defenses, and it's short because the U.S. is not selling them enough. And let's remember, the U.S. no longer supplies this for free. They sell weapons to the Europeans, who then pass them on to the Ukrainians. And there is an objective shortage, and the Europeans also don't make enough of these air defense missiles either. But if you look at the front line in Ukraine, the situation is not desperate, it's not dire. The front line has barely budged since that famous encounter in the White House between President Zelensky and President Trump almost a year ago, in which President Trump said, you have no cards, you have to settle on Russian terms. And the Ukrainian army has shown with its innovation ability and honestly with the courage of the Ukrainian defenders that it's able to hold the front line against a much bigger foe like Russia.
Yaroslav, President Zelensky says he's now agreed specific packages of new energy and military support within a matter of weeks. That includes air defense missiles. Are they really operating the Ukrainian fighters on this kind of hand-to-mouth, they need the missiles now for just to get through the next few weeks, or is there a bigger stockpile than that?
Well, the problem is that you will never have enough air defense missiles because it's much cheaper to make your attack weapons than your defense weapons in this air war. And, you know, Russia has proven that thanks to Chinese support, thanks to the smuggling of quite a large amount of Western components, it was able to ramp up its military production. And it's making a lot of these missiles, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles. And also it's making thousands and thousands of drones that have become much more sophisticated, that are harder and harder to intercept. And we're talking about several hundred drones tracking Ukraine almost every night. And so in this sort of environment, the Western industrial capacity is not sufficient to produce enough air defenses. That's just a hard fact of life. And on top of that, the U.S. is reprioritizing these defenses for its own purposes, for the purposes of defending allies like Israel. And so clearly Ukraine is not on the top of the priority list for the Trump administration.
Picking up on that, Yaroslav, in Davos, President Zelensky referred to it as Groundhog Day. Is there any sense after Munich that that's going to change?
Oh, not at all, not at all. I mean, everyone I spoke to in everyone I spoke with in Munich, you know, European defense officials, Ukrainians, I mean, they all expect this war to last, you know, for at least a year, maybe more, because President Putin still thinks he can win. He has no intention of settling on anything close to acceptable terms to Ukraine or to its European partners. You know, he will not take anything less than a Ukrainian surrender. And the Ukrainians are not going to surrender because they know the cost of surrender. And they also have not lost the war. And so the Russian political aspirations in this war that are not changed, are not matched by Russian military abilities.
How cold is it? And how have people actually been able to survive during the extensive raids and hits on the energy infrastructure in Kyiv?
Well, it's going to get warmer soon. So again, you know, Ukrainians have suffered a lot this winter, and this was the coldest winter in many, many years, a very unusually cold for Ukraine. And, you know, you also have to consider that in most of Ukrainian apartment blocks, the heating is centralized. It all comes from these big, big facilities. People don't have individual heating in their apartments. And so once you destroy this heating station that serves an entire, you know, neighborhood of a city, you know, it starts to get very cold. And obviously, at the same time, you have electricity shortages. So people have been going to the so-called resilience centers that the government has established everywhere, where you can get a hot meal and spend, you know, some hours in warmth. But obviously, it's been very, very hard. But again, we are now coming to the end of this, and this enormous campaign of pressure was designed by Russia to force the Ukrainian people to put pressure on the government to settle the war at any cost and to surrender. But that hasn't worked. You didn't have any protests against President Zelensky. You didn't have any demonstrations demanding a surrender. And now everyone knows that, well, you know, the winter is coming to an end and things will be much better in the next few months.
So the Russians really need to press home their advantage, I guess, at this moment, or make their case to the Americans. There are negotiations underway, Yaroslav. Again, this time in Geneva. The Russians say they want to focus on a broader range of issues, particularly questions of territory this time around. But can both sides even agree on what they need to talk about at this point?
Well, you know, the most fundamental issue here is territory, because it appears that at the meeting in Alaska between President Trump and President Putin in August last year, President Trump told the Russians, okay, well, you know, you can take the two regions of Donbass, Donetsk, and Luhansk in their entirety, and we freeze the front line in the other two regions of Kherson and Zaporizhia. And this is what the Russians now refer to as the, you know, Anchorage understandings. Anchorage, Alaska was the place where Putin and Trump met. Now, the problem with that is that Ukraine still controls a large chunk of the Donetsk region, and it has no intention of giving it to Russia with all its inhabitants at the time where Russia has been unable to conquer it militarily. It will take years, probably, for Russia at the current pace of advance to take those areas. And that's a sticking point, because as the Ukrainians see it, why would we give this strategic terrain that is so crucial for our own defenses, there's urban areas that are really extremely heavily fortified, to Russia in exchange for nothing? Because, I mean, most Ukrainians you talk to will tell you that, you know, if you give these areas to Russia, they will just use them to launch the next phase of this war. And then there will be nothing to stop them, because beyond those areas, it's actually pretty open terrain. And so Ukraine, unfortunately, has a lot of experience with Russia violating all sorts of promises. You know, let's not forget that back in the 90s, Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons and its strategic bomber fleet in exchange for American and Russian, you know, assurances of respecting Ukraine's independence and territorial integrity. Now it's the U.S. that is joining Russia in pressing Ukraine to give up its territory, violating also this so-called Budapest Memorandum. And then you had in 2014, 2015, the so-called Minsk agreements, again under which Russia committed to a settlement of this conflict by peaceful terms, and that too was violated. And so there is very little expectation in Ukraine that Russia will hold to its end of the bargain. And, okay, the U.S. is saying we will provide some sort of vague, undefined, so far, security guarantees. But, you know, the only real security guarantee for Ukraine is a strong Ukrainian army, because if anyone else was going to go to war on Ukraine's behalf, they would have done it now. You know, people who don't want to do it now are not going to do it in 2 or 3 years' time.
But there is leverage that can be used here, isn't there, particularly by the European Union? I mean, Kaja Kallas, the foreign policy chief, spoke at Munich and said that, key Russian demands, including the lifting of sanctions, unfreezing assets, that they are decisions for Europe. So they do hold some cards, some indeed that they haven't played yet. Will they ever be played?
That's the crux of the matter. You know, America does not hold all the cards, or even most of the cards. I mean, because if you look at the situation now, you know, it's the Europeans, not the Americans, who are paying for this war. You know, the European Union just approved a 90 billion euro package of aid for Ukraine, military and civilian. The Russian frozen assets, you know, upwards of $300 million are in European custody. Not in American custody, and the U.S. cannot just release this money without European consent. And if you look at the trade before this war, you know, the U.S. didn't have much of a trade with Russia. Europe did. And so it's the European sanctions that have a very serious impact on this. And the Europeans are not going to relax any of that just to please the Trump administration. I mean, the European nations are very much aware that the security of Ukraine is their own national security, and that a Russian victory in Ukraine would put Europe itself in much graver danger. So it's existential for them.
Yaroslav, I read with great interest the report put out by the Estonian Foreign Intelligence Service last week, and it made some really interesting observations about the situation inside Russia, which is one of the hardest places to observe and have good, detailed, thorough knowledge about. And it said that while they don't expect an uprising or the collapse of the Russian economy, that Putin was under greatest strain this year heading in, and that actually you could see some real cracks within the Russian economy within, say, 6 months. What is your assessment of the internal situation in Russia and Putin's own ability to withstand? We've talked a lot to you about Ukraine's ability to withstand constant attacks. How is Putin measuring up?
Well, it's a very good question. And, you know, Ukraine is not paying for its war. Thankfully, it has allies that are putting in a lot of cash into its war effort. Russia is paying for its own war. Nobody is going to fund it externally. Not the Chinese, not the Iranians, not the North Koreans, for sure. And so, and the main source of income for the Russian economy is oil, and oil prices have been declining in general. And in particular, the Urals crude, the Russian kind of oil, because of international sanctions, because of the pressure on buyers of Russian oil, like India, by the U.S. administration, and because of the pressure on the so-called shadow fleet. And so that income stream has been drying up. Russia has, in the meantime, spent most of its sovereign wealth fund. And it's a very expensive proposition, this war. You know, Russia is recruiting about 35,000 soldiers, new soldiers, every month. And it's losing about 30,000 killed or severely injured in Ukraine. So it's this meat grinder that goes on. And up until now, it was able to sustain this by relying on volunteers. It's paying a lot of money to the soldiers who are ready to go and fight in a war in which they know that the odds of coming back in one piece are not that high. But it's no longer going to be able to afford to do this for much longer. And the moment they will start forcing people to fight is the moment when social tension may appear in Russia and protests may actually appear. Because up until now, you know, people are in Russia are saying, well, you know, they chose to go and fight. So, you know, we're not going to be protesting about their death. At the same time, inflation is going to pick up. And also a lot of the social welfare cuts that Russia avoided until now will become inevitable. And that will also create social pressure on the government. And we can't really say how long it will last. We can't really say, you know, how it will manifest itself in this sort of societies, but, you know, they are not impervious to domestic unrest.
Yaroslav, it's pretty obvious Ukraine is not going to get NATO as part of a long-term security guarantee that could potentially help resolve this imperial agenda of Russia. But EU membership is something that is supposedly on the table, and yet we saw Zelensky ask for a firm date on this and none given by the EU. Where is EU membership at? And if Ursula von der Leyen is talking about bringing mutual defence clauses in the EU treaty to life, is that somewhat of a even stronger security guarantee for Ukraine if they do get membership in the end?
Well, obviously, the European Union membership is very important for a variety of reasons. Also, for investment, for reconstruction after the war, and for anchoring Ukraine inside Europe. And also, honestly, but though, if we talk about security guarantees, I mean, it's the Ukraine membership in the EU that will be security guarantee for the EU, because Ukraine has the biggest, the strongest army in Europe and the only one with combat experience. And so it's now, I remember when, 3 years ago, Ukrainian soldiers were being trained by German or French militaries. Well, now, you know, we have in the new stage, where the Ukrainians are coming to Germany to train the German military because they know how to fight a modern war and the German military doesn't. And so without a Ukraine inside Europe, especially at a time where the transatlantic relationship is so unreliable, you know, European security could not really be assured long term.
Yaroslav, what brings this to an end? We're nearly at 4 years of fighting. Next week, it's the four-year anniversary of the Russians rolling into Ukraine. What finishes it?
Well, you know, I spoke to one of the Ukrainian ministers who had this to say. This war ends in one of two ways, either with the disappearance of Ukraine or the disappearance of the Russian imperial idea, which holds that, you know, we have to expand and swallow more and more countries. And neither of this is going to happen this year. And so I think even if we may have a short-term truce down the line, and this is a conflict that unfortunately will last much longer than we all hoped for. And it's already lasted longer than the Soviet Union's war against Nazi Germany. which was the defining conflict in the Russian collective memory for the 20th century.
Yaroslav, thank you so much for joining us and being generous with your time. Much to think about there, and devastating really to think about how unnecessarily it seems this war is to be prolonged.
Thank you, and good to be on the show.
Kylie, as ever, Yaroslav is so well informed about the situation in Ukraine. But what I really took out from that was just how solidified this conflict is becoming, and sobering to think that it's outlasted the World War II front that the Soviets fought against the Germans. When you put it like that, and taking into consideration that in Russia they don't even call this a war, it is just one of those step back moments at 4 years in, and you realize, wow, the world has changed so much, and yet we're still incapable of resolving this.
And he, when he talked about the front line situation and the fact that it's not vastly changed, you know, there's been a massive cost to human life, and you know, the destruction of cities and so many thousands of missiles fired and drone attacks, but it hasn't really altered what the battlefield looks like. And then it just created for me a sense of things being frozen. You know, you have the Europeans there with potential tools that they can use in terms of frozen Russian assets, but they're not really being used. They keep threatening to use them, but they're not. The Ukrainians are saying, look, give us security guarantees to Washington, and then we have something to talk about. The Americans, I was looking into it earlier, the Americans are offering 15-year guarantees at the moment, and the Ukrainians want a commitment lasting between 30 and 50 years. So that's at a dead end. The territory is at a dead end. The Ukrainians are insistent that they're not going to give up the kind of land that the Russians are demanding. And so you just have this sense that it just keeps spinning out. And as Yaroslav said, you know, there is a consensus that this lasts for at least another year, but perhaps more.
And this really is the question for the international community now, particularly in the context that we can't rely upon the United States to be a trusted and forthcoming partner. What does aid to Ukraine look like? What does support for Ukraine look like? What does standing with Ukraine mean in the context of this war not finishing? Because I think for a long time, the West has been giving aid and supporting Ukraine in a very ad hoc fashion, because we've all been under the assumption that it could end tomorrow. It might end with a counteroffensive. Oh, Trump's coming in. Trump says he'll end it within a day. Of course, Trump's not going to end it within a day, but it shows there's a new resolve. Well, that resolve may be abating. This is the huge question I don't think the West has begun to grapple with yet. If Ukraine is in this war for several more years to come, at least one more, according to Yaroslav, what's our commitment look like?
It's another busy week on Global Roaming, and we always love to hear from you. So please don't forget to write to us. We like your questions. We like your feedback. So please keep all that coming. Our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au.
You can listen in 11 a.m. or 9 p.m. on Radio National, or at any time on ABC Listen. See you later.
Bye, Latika.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.